What are you doing up at this hour of the night?
What are you doing up at this hour of the night?
Prevention of crime. Every hour of the day and night.
Movie.
Break.
Is the team that protects your property and you.
Hello and welcome to the Movie Break podcast. This is a premiere in a sense. This is the first time that we are recording this in English from a film festival. My name is Patrick and next to me is Lida.
Hi.
Yeah, this is the Sundance Film Festival. We are here together for the first time. We have each been individually here before. I have been here in 2019 and Lida, you have been here...
Last year, actually. It was my first time and yeah, happy to be back.
Yeah, how does it feel compared to last year? For me, it's so long ago that I hardly remember.
Well, it's last year was all like, first festival is always being totally like starry-eyed and enthusiastic about everything. And second time you see everything a little bit more, let's say, realistic, not negative, but realistic. So that's what's happening this time. But it's still a lot of fun to be here. And it's not as cold and snowy, which makes it just so much easier to move around.
Yeah, so much easier to move around, even though... We can't really say that we will adjust ourselves to it because this is also the last edition of the festival here in Park City in Utah, close to where Robert Redford began this all. We are reminded a lot this year because, of course, of his passing last year. And everyone is talking about Robert Redford and how he built this all up. I think the first editions actually took place in Salt Lake City.
Exactly. And then Sidney Pollack, or at least according to legend, Sidney Pollack suggested to also move the festival to Park City because this is like a famous or like a very popular ski resort. So there are a lot of people. And then they just thought they could get like bigger audiences. And this is how the festival came to happen in two places at the same time, which is very unusual for film festivals.
Yeah, which also in a way makes it more difficult for people to travel here, right? I mean, Salt Lake City just has the airport here and has more accommodation availability as well. Here it's a bit more cramped and packed, but that also means the density of people is much higher and you basically stumble into people all the time.
Yeah, and if you know film festivals, you know that for some reason, like 80% of the film festivals seem to be in some small, tiny towns like Locarno, Cannes. These aren't necessarily big cities apart from the film festivals that are happening there.
Yeah, and next year we should mention that the festival moves to Boulder, which by no means is a huge place, but compared to Park City, which I think has a population of like 5,000 or 8,000 or
yeah,
so.
Yeah, I think Boulder is something like 3 million.
I think it's 100,000 or so. It's a small place.
100,000. I thought like at least a few million, but okay, that is, well, okay, but, for whatever reason, mystery.
But it is a college town after all, and I guess it naturally draws young folks even more there, so that's exciting, I guess. And yeah, Lida, looking at this lineup, was there something in particular this year that drew your attention?
It's kind of hard to say because there are many films that you don't know a lot about, which I think it's a good thing for an independent film festival that it's not as in Cannes where you often have big dramas from always the same directors where you have a pretty good idea what you're gonna see, but I was very curious for The Lake, actually, the documentary that we're later gonna talk about. And then there's my favorite section, The Midnight Slate, which turned out to be one of the best sections last year with films like The Ugly Stepdaughter. So I'm very happy to see that again. And that's
stepdaughter
not
or stepsister?
Stepsister. Okay. Yeah. Oh, The Ugly Stepsister. So many step family. But so. Other than from festivals like Cannes or Venice, I'm not so much orienting myself, just like you told me the other day, on the competition. And also We have here four main competitions, which is also very, very different.
It's true. And Sundance is traditionally situated as a festival that much more fosters the documentary form as well. Often when it comes to award seasons, we find Sundance documentaries in the slate as well of the films that are nominated. Actually, a few days ago, they announced the Oscar nominations, but I don't have on my mind how many documentaries made it from Sundance up to this year's Academy Awards. But be that as it may, we want to talk about some films here as well. We should also mention that some of the very exclusive titles actually don't land in these competition sections, right? There's the premiere section and there's the next section. You know, as with many film festivals, there is sometimes an issue if in clearly making out what distinguishes them, what sets them apart. But one can tell that I think especially the premiere and next section are more transgressive, or they try to be transgressive. I still think compared to some European festivals, Sundance is a bit more mainstream in a way, so it caters to certain expectations of the audience, which doesn't have to be a bad thing. It's a different register of movies, I think, that you come across here.
Yeah, and actually that has been, I feel like, a point of discussion among many people now that the festival is moving, how much of the original spirit, when it was really completely unknown directors, small tiny movies, and these days, you know, many independent films, which is still the main feature of the Sundance Film Festival, they can be like multi-million dollar productions. So today, actually, I'm gonna, which I look very much forward to, see the new film with Olivia Colman, Wicker, and that's such a big budget film. That's like a glossy Hollywood film, and even though it's technically independent, you would really say, like, why is that here, you know, as much as I love Olivia Colman.
Is that an A24 film? Do you know that?
I think so, but I'm never so good with the production studios, because I usually remember the director or the actors, but production studios.
Yeah, it also gets confusing, because sometimes, of course, one of the reasons why the festival takes place is also, of course, to get some deals done. So there are some distributors that are looking for titles here at the festival, and I don't know if this already has distribution. But in any case, let's maybe talk about some movies we've seen. I think one of the biggest titles that I will talk about next episode is Josephine, which right before the festival started, I think, was announced to be this year's Sundance film in the Berlinale competition as well, which has now become a tradition. We had Past Lives. We had If I'd Legs, I'd Kick You. We had A Different Man. So there is this ongoing, I think it's also always A24, you know, there's this Sundance A24 film that gets into Berlinale competition. So there's clearly some trajectories that are, you know, scheduled out beforehand. But yeah, this is to be discussed on our next episode. I would like to start with one title that drew so much attention here, and people were crowding up and front of the theater, mainly due to its star, Charlie XCX. And This Is the Moment, another A24 film here, which I think will soon release in the US as well, because I saw that there are some screenings in New York scheduled already, where I'm currently based. And yeah, this is, you know, inspired by an idea of Charlie XCX. Of course, this is basically her story, and people on stage after the film screened, they said, this is Spinal Brat, you know. They refer to, of course, what's his name? The filmmaker who died last year, unfortunately, Spinal Tap.
I know which one you mean, but I forgot the name right at the moment.
When Harry Met Sally, what's his name? Now the filmmaker doesn't come to mind. That's so unfortunate. But in any case, people talked a lot about the mockumentary aspect of it, because it is a fiction feature, but it's clearly inspired by a lot of experiences that she has.
Rob Reiner.
Yeah, Rob Reiner, of course. May he rest in peace. And this, I have to say, was interesting. I didn't expect much of this film, because I was fearful that this film wasn't going to be mature enough in a way. Not that I expect like some auteurism here, but rather it's difficult to capture this sort of spirit of being young and being a pop star, being out there creating all this kind of buzz and creating all this fandom that she has created over the past years with Brett Summer and everything. And here the basic premise is that Charlie XCX, you know, she bears the same name as in real life here, as a pop star, as a singer, songwriter. she wants to end this. She wants to end the Bread Summer. But there's this tension because her entire entourage, especially where the label and so on is concerned, they want the Bread Summer, of course, to go on forever because that's how they make the money. And this tension is at the heart of the film. And I must say, this is sort of an ADHD film. And capturing that is not as easy as I think, not as easy at all, I think. So there is, the editing is insane, I think. There's a lot of strobo as well going on that we've come to associate with her as well. I must say I'm not very acquainted with her, not very well acquainted with her work. I don't think I've listened to one song. Are you familiar with her?
Not at all.
Maybe that's about our age as well, that it says something about our age. But in any case, I think it was quite well done. We have also Alexander Skarsgård, who becomes more and more of an antagonistic character in this, because he is hired as a photographer to make a concert film about the tour that is about to start, the Bread Summer tour. And he has different ideas. He is very, a very corporate guy. You know, he represents the big corporations, Disney, and wants to make it all family friendly. There cannot be words like cunt in there. He wants to make it, he wants to think about the families and so on that might watch this concert film that this is all centered on, creating this concert film. And yeah, what can I say? This is a debut as well by Aidan Zamiri. He's, I think, friends with Charlie XCX, and I'm surprised, but I would recommend this film. It's well made. It also hides a lot of things, and there's this idea that if you blink, you will miss things. And this is sort of reflected also in how people communicate. Everything is on the phone, and like everyone is on the phone the entire time. Text messages, voice messages, it goes in and out, and people don't have a break, basically. And is this a film you're looking forward to?
I'm very interested to see it, and I also announced the plan here that we hope to see, or I hope to cover all films that are both in Sundance and Berlinale, which is about a dozens of film, maybe with the help of Patrick. So let's see, and I'm definitely, it sounds definitely very interesting.
Yeah, and I even, there's a certain formula that you would expect, you know, the artist that develops this kind of hubris and then feels the need to apologize at the end. But the way the film captures this, you know, like there's, you know, these films when they have this monologue toward the end where they apologize to all the people that they treated badly and so on. Here, this is all rendered in a voice message, and I think this is so of our time, you know, and in other films, you would have the monologue that would be sort of an extra diegetic element almost, you know, that is talking more to the audience than to the characters themselves. But here, it's this very mundane thing of a voice message that is sent on the phone while she's, you know, lying around leisurely. So I like these kind of little spins to a genre that is very much explored, and I think this certainly adds something to the genre. So yeah, recommendation for me. What do you have for us, Lida?
Well, at first I'd just like to very quickly mention Tuna, which already premiered at, I think it was a Telluride actually, and then it was at TIFF, so it was at a few festivals, but here it ran again, and it's, well, maybe only well known for Dustin Hoffman acting it and Leo Woodall. It's a crime comedy. It was very unremarkable. And the thing that struck me most about this film was that the press screening was running exactly after a documentary named Silence, which was about women speaking out about sexual harassment and being silenced by the media and by the courts. So the fact that Dustin Hoffman, who has quite a history of being accused of sexual misconduct, that this film is slated the press screening exactly after this documentary was so bitter and ironic, that's the most really remarkable thing that I can say about Tuna, which otherwise was utterly forgettable. But then there was so far my favorite film in the festival, and I already see that will be hard to supersede Buddy. So Buddy, the screening was crowded. It's in the midnight slate, and this is like a parody of a character that we all know and fear, Barney the Dinosaur. So it's a parody, a horror parody of this kind of saccharine, forcefully positive, toxically idealistic children's film world where everything is happy crappy, and the main character Buddy, which is a unicorn, just definitely modeled after Barney. It's an orange unicorn, you know, in one of those costumes where you just see that there's a person underneath in this world where everything is anthropomorphic, like deeply disturbing. If the trash can speaks to you, these things are just like insane, but in children's films they're somehow okay, and this is like where this character goes rampant.
And so the trash bin, does it want to be filled or does it reject the trash?
Well, that's the thing, like, and the trash bin is forced to be made complicit in a murder because it has to hide certain murder evidence.
Oh,
the mailbox, which is speaking air, is mutilated, so because it becomes a witness to another murder. Nice friendly characters are just slaughtered, and it's, but this film has really a very clever and interesting message and subtext, which is that this world that these 90s children's shows are presenting is really manipulative, indoctrinating, and toxic. This idea that you just have to repress negative feelings, or that negative things simply do not exist in this world. That if there's something you feel bad about, well, just sing a song and be happy again. And this is in our age of forceful happiness. I think this is very timely. And the Barney series, they also drew a lot of critique. I don't know if people who are a little bit younger or older are aware of that, but they drew a lot of critique, especially from the people who were very fond of Sesame Street, because Sesame Street was revolutionary for being like groundbreaking and including themes like divorce, addiction, HIV, poverty, incarceration. All these themes were in Sesame Street, where it was taught to children it's okay to be sad. You can deal with these things. You can have HIV and still be like a worthy person. And this was, Sesame Street was banned in many countries, including in the US, for being so groundbreaking. And Barney is just the opposite of that.
Ah, interesting. I've never really watched the show.
Yeah, Casper Kelly's Buddy, a lot of bloody fun.
Okay. And is there any notion of, like, is there something of a trauma plot or something in there, or something that you actually can heal or something? Because that I encounter so often in these Sundance films, and I'm sort of fed up with it. I don't want to see these notions of, oh yeah, we all just have to heal, and I don't know, is that present in that film?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a classical trauma. There is an idea of loss, and more like, but it's not so much trauma, it's more like how the media and society pressure make us just like forget who we really are. They just like numb us into being like uniformous, assimilated people who just go to life like completely apathetic. And this, I thought, was a pretty interesting, accurate idea. And actually also the idea that violence can be cathartic, and that sometimes you have to be violent to just defend yourself. And I think that's true. You cannot always like just smile and pretend everything is okay.
Oh, very cool. You know, there was not a film, I don't know, you sometimes have to base your assessment on the stills you're provided with, and the still didn't quite had me, but now as you talk about it, I think I will check that out. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, the still was a fluffy unicorn with an X, and that just had me instantly. I just wanted to see that film no matter what.
That's where we differ, Lita. But let's go on. I want to talk about a film, also a debut, like the moment I mentioned earlier. This is Joy Bubbles by Rachel J. Morrison. And Joy Bubbles tells the story of, well, a man who later named himself Joy Bubbles. So he changed his name because it's sort of a Peter Pan story of someone who was born blind and, however, was greatly gifted. He figured out at some point, because, you know, he spent a lot of time with the telephone, actually. And he figured out that if he whispered in a certain way, you know, this is like in the 60s, 70s, if he whispered in a certain way, he could circumvent the restrictions of AT&T, which had the monopoly at the time, is still, of course, a hugely big player in telecommunication. And through these different whispers in different pitches, he was able to call even like long distance calls to the other coast in the US. And this became a media sensation, actually, that a blind guy who, especially at the time, was hardly given any credit for, you know, being just a worthy part of society. And it was super interesting in the first half of the movie. The first half of the movie is actually more of an experimental film based mostly on footage from the time, and even a lot of interviews were from back then. So it had some, you know, low-res interviews, and it has actually analog, you know, when there's not even an image, just the flickering and so on. So it uses that also as a structural device, and it was so interesting because I thought, oh, here is a film that actually takes its audience seriously. It doesn't explain at first thoroughly who that person is. It hints at the fact that he, so Joy Bubbles, may have faced sexual abuse in his childhood. But as we turn into the second half of the film, it undoes it completely. And suddenly we go into the territory of emotionalizing the audience, giving us all his backstory and making it somehow a very conventional documentary that I found very unfortunate, because if you want to be true to that sort of mind, you know, that sort of avant-garde thinker in a way, it's unfortunate to then see the form in which this is rendered become more and more conventional. I would nevertheless truly recommend this one. I think you learn a lot just about the culture back then as well. You see a lot of the media coverage from the time and how people just dealt with him. You know, there's this entire idea that he was all looking for a job. You know, he did so many things to get a job because no one wanted to hire a blind guy, even though he was highly gifted, and it was often mentioned in the film that if he had not been blind, he would have easily gotten a job at IBM or AT&T or what have you. So it's a very painful story. This guy then ended up being, you know, without steady income, without even health insurance properly, and so on. And I think he died with a like congested heart or something, you know, with a it's a sad story, but I wish it had been more true to itself. Is that a film that is also on your radar?
More or less. The thing is that I kind of have made my peace with myself that I won't be able to watch Joy Bubbles because there are so many other films. Mm-hmm. And also then there's to write about the film. So right, it's not for us to watch about them, but to write them. And it probably won't be possible. If I watch it, then it will be in the final days of the festival when it all gets a bit quieter and you have a better idea of how far you've gotten with your work.
Yeah. I, in any case, would recommend to everyone to check out his wiki in the very least. You know, it's at some point later in life when he lived by himself, humble existence, he had this sort of phone service where he got the last entry of the phone book, and I forgot what it was. I think it was like Zizzerific or something, so he created this own adjective. And when people called this hotline, they would be forwarded to a pre-recorded message by him that would change every week. So he would every week change the message, and then he would just reflect upon life and would then even become friends over the phone with many people. And these people are also being interviewed in the documentary. And as you might be able to predict already, these people become more and more the talking heads in the second half of the documentary, and that's where it loses all its steam. But I would still recommend this one, not wholeheartedly, but yeah, it's a fascinating story and I'm glad that it was told. And Lida, you have a second film as well?
Yeah, I have one more, and that's a documentary, and maybe the topical documentary for Perk City and Salt Lake City. It's The Lake, about the threatening collapse of the Great Salt Lake, which is one of the biggest lakes in the world. There's like, it's as huge as the Aral Sea, which is often used as a comparison. And water level is constantly sinking. There are dust storms, toxic dust storms with arsenic dust coming up, people getting health issues. And of course, also the water loss itself presents a very real problem. And as so often in politics, there are those who warn that the collapse is immediate and that it will just be a few more years, like 3 or 5 more years, until the sea will completely, the whole ecosystem will collapse. And those who say, oh, it will just not happen, which are always the conservative politicians who are just like, that won't happen. And so this documentary deals with that, and it's a very urgent topic. It's very important for the area, and Leonardo DiCaprio has produced, so it's a lot of like buzz attached to it. But I can now use this word, which I can never use in German podcasts, underwhelmed. Mm-hmm. I was very underwhelmed by it, because it's not as forceful as it should be, and then there's a lot of it gets lost in the little stories of the people connected to researching on the lake, in the politics. It doesn't make a very clear political stance, kind of seems to want to please all sides. And then there was also this bit that it goes very much into the religion of the people, and we see a lot of people praying, and there are multiple shots of the Bible and people quoting from the Bible, and this doesn't really go anywhere. And it seems like a weird like religious undertone of this film, which is basically about an ecological and scientific problem. And let's not forget that religion has often been like, or especially politics, religion, conservative, and all wrapped up, have often been like an opposing force to ecological science, with the idea like, oh, God will solve that problem. There are a few very interesting statements from Christian or like Mormon scientists who say that, like, okay, God gave us this earth not to destroy, and we have to solve our own problems. So we cannot just, God wants us to solve these problems. God wants us to protect the environment and not just lean back and say like, oh, we're waiting for the miracle. And I think this is a very nice idea to show that you can be deeply religious but still care about the environment and still believe in science, that it doesn't have to be a contradiction. But still, it left a very uncomfortable feeling.
You know, it's maybe a side note, but this reminds me also, I recently saw a Zizek interview where he says that hope is maybe misguided often. We should rather strive for desperation, because hope often doesn't lead to action, you know, whereas desperation does lead to action.
Yeah, and I also actually totally agree with that. I think that hope is toxic.
Yeah.
That hope completely poisons you, and often also keeps you in unfortunate situations, like where you just think, oh, hopefully it will be better, but really, really it won't. Hope is completely poisonous. Well, with this bitter note with this existentialist bitter note, we leave you to your joyful day.
Yeah, and we could maybe already reveal what we're talking about next time. I really want to talk about Josephine. This is one of the most sought after films here. As said before, it's in the Berlinale competition as well. So that will be interesting. And I will talk about my favorite film so far, which is William Greaves' Once Upon a Time in Harlem. And something you might want to
absolutely about The Wicker, the Olivia Colman film, and then Olivia Wilde's comedy The Invite with a star cast, Edward Norton, Penelope Cruz, Seth Rogen. So these two will definitely be mentioned. And we can talk about the Harlem film, which I've also seen. So.
Yeah, that's true. And perhaps also Greg Araki's I Want Your Sex, because that is, of course, one of the buzziest titles here.
And he's a veteran of the festival, of course, so always up for some fun.
In the meantime, thank you, Lita, and see you next time.
See you around.